Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters today, July 10th, 2005. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And it is a truly lovely summer day here in the heartland. Today we're going to be talking with the editor and the publisher of a newspaper, a national newspaper based nearby in Chicago, In These Times, one of the leading progressive voices for the past three decades in the United States. Talk about what's going on there, what's going on in the world, the role of progressive media, the shape of media in general. Today, join us on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
New bills pending in Congress would give phone companies the right to provide video service in competition with cable companies, but they would also tie the hands of local governments when it comes to making sure such service is reliable. Companion bills in the House and Senate would require phone companies to pay local franchise fees like cable companies currently do. The bills would also require them to provide public, educational, and government access channels on their video networks. There's already a full court ad blitz underway in support of this legislation by the cable and phone company's chief lobbying arm, the United States Telecom Association.
Most of us focus on what kind of information we get, not how we get it. So why does the government still distinguish between how information and entertainment is delivered? Today, Congress uses outdated laws that regulate some kinds of telecom companies more than others. These arbitrary laws just don't make sense. It's time to put an end to burdensome telecom regulations.
However, none of the proposed bills provide any provisions for local governments to hold phone companies accountable for network outages or for dangerous and defective wiring. There isn't even a provision to enforce the payment of local franchise fees. In effect, if Congress approves these changes to the regulatory system, it will effectively gut provisions for local oversight of cable and phone networks, as well as silence any meaningful avenues for local feedback about service quality. Yet the bills have bipartisan backing, and it's expected they may make it through Congress by the end of the year.
Supporters of public broadcasting are striking back at conservative attempts to defund and defang both NPR and PBS. 52 members of the House of Representatives signed a letter to Corporation for Public Broadcasting Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson demanding his resignation. According to the letter, quote, allowing political party priorities to infect the governance of CPB is debilitating to the work of public broadcasting and inconsistent with both the letter and spirit of your charter, unquote. These 52 representatives join 16 senators who've already written to President Bush seeking Tomlinson's ouster. Public broadcasters are also marshaling support to restore some $100 million in funding that's still on the federal chopping block. Most of those cuts target children's programming.
An increasing level of secrecy in government has made it harder for the public to peer into the workings of many federal agencies. This has had a negative impact on the use of the Freedom of Information Act, a law first passed in 1966 that mandated government release of publicly requested information except in extreme circumstances. Now there's proposals floating in D.C. to add new teeth to the FOIA law. The proposals would create a mediator for disputes between members of the public who want government information and agencies reluctant to give it up. They would also mandate a deadline for agencies to respond to FOIA requests and would impose fines on those who failed to meet the deadline. Yet the proposals would not require agencies to release any actual information in a timely manner, just respond to initial requests with a yes or no answer. Nor would they clear up a growing backlog of FOIA filings. Some 4 million Freedom of Information Act requests were submitted to federal agencies last year.
Work continues on the drafting of revisions to the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And while one of the leading Senate Republicans working on the initiative has promised to hold public hearings on the process, that promise has yet to be fulfilled. However, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska has held several private listening sessions with corporate interests, including executives from the broadcast, telecommunications, and computer hardware and software industries. As chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, Stevens has the power to make or break any bill related to telecom issues. Neither Stevens nor any other members of the Commerce Committee will speak publicly about these private meetings.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. The fastest growing segment of the advertising world is that of product placements, when advertisers pay for mentions or displays of their products or services within the context of a program or story. Product placement is an insidious form of advertising in that it's not clear to a reader or viewer that they're experiencing a sales pitch, but you can expect much more of it in the future. The Nielsen Company now tracks product placements in TV shows and says they've shot up nearly 30% over last year, with nearly 13,000 product placements in primetime shows in the first quarter of 2005 alone. Reality TV is the most popular place for product placement, accounting for more than 23,000 instances in 2004. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on this lovely July 10th, 2005, from our studios in Campbell Hall at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And it is a pleasure to be back. You know, I was on the road for a few weeks in June and unable to do the show, and we had tape shows. But we're back now, and I think we'll be pretty much set of live shows through July, August, into the fall. We're setting up a number of programs I think you're going to be interested in, and so stay tuned. Next week, for example, our guest is going to be Danny Schechter, the news dissector, who's just coming back from a trip to Europe, where he's been covering the G8, and he's been involved in covering the terrorist bombing in London. And to get his feedback on the media coverage and what's going on over there, I think it's going to be a tremendous show. We're very fortunate to have Danny Schechter queued up to appear with us 1 week from today. Last week, at the end of the show, I tried to give folks information on how they could sign up to get our weekly e-blast that we send to regular listeners of the show. Now, several hundred, maybe as many as 1,000 of you are getting these weekly emails, and there's been a request that we make this information more readily available on air. And we're working on having something a lot simpler, because the current web page you have to go to has about 300 different characters and the address, and I don't want to read them over the air. But if you do go to the uiuc.edu webpage, will.uiuc.edu, Will as in Will Radio, and then you click through to the show Media Matters, you will find there information on all the shows we've done. If you want to download them, all of them are available. And if you'd like to get onto our mailing list, all you need to do is go to my personal website for now, which is simply robertmcchesney.com, and you can click there to get on the weekly email list. And if you do that, you'll get an email every week with an update on what the upcoming show is going to be, information on past shows, and links to books, articles, websites for our guests. So if you're interested in a guest, you can follow through and learn more about them. So once again, just go to robertmcchesney.com if you're interested in signing up for the email list, and go to the will.uiuc.edu website if you want to see back the whole archive of every show we've done, the podcasts for them. You can listen to them at your convenience anytime you want, and that's at the Will website. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and today we have a terrific show for you. Not far from here, 150 miles up to the north of us, pretty much due north, in the city of Chicago, the headquarters of a national weekly newspaper, biweekly newspaper, called In These Times. It's a paper I have to confess that I got my own start in journalism working with in the 1970s as the distribution director for In These Times in Seattle in the Pacific Northwest. And I presently serve on its board, although I might be the most negligent board member in the history of publishing. So I say that as a way of editorial admission at the beginning of the show. And our guests today on the show are going to be the current acting publisher of In These Times, Tracy Van Slyke, and Jessica Clark, the managing editor. So we're delighted to welcome them. Tracy, Jessica?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Bob.
You're both there. Great. We got you on the same line, which shows the high technology.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's what's happened with WILL. We can really crack all the technological problems. So it's the Urbana effect, too. I mean, we invented invented the internet, and we can get two people on the same phone line. It's quite
strange. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, well, it's really an honor to have you here. And, you know, before we get started, I think we've probably got some listeners who aren't familiar with In These Times and its history and what it's about. So could you just say a few words to give some background for people who might not be familiar with the newspaper?
Jess, why don't you take that?
Sure. The magazine's been around since 1976. Started as a newspaper, as Bob's been saying. Switched to magazine format in the 80s. It was founded by James Weinstein. Our founder, unfortunately, just died recently. He was a fairly well-known socialist historian, very influential, and kind of ahead of his time in wanting to move beyond some of the sectarian battles of the left in the late 70s and into a more pragmatic, electorally focused progressive politics. So we're trying to keep his legacy alive by working with some of the similar groups that have now sprung up and sort of show that he knew what he was talking about, and we do too.
Yeah, it's a great magazine that covers a lot of different news that you don't see in the mainstream media. It covers a lot of the movements and different organizing events happening in the progressive movement.
And how frequently is In These Times published now?
It's biweekly.
Biweekly.
Yep. So, and we have a website that we update pretty frequently as well.
And the website is inthesetimes.com.
Yep. And we have a blog we update pretty periodically, but not as much as we want.
Now, how would Jessica? How would you compare In These Times to, say, the Progressive Magazine or The Nation, in terms of the sort of stuff you do, and maybe the political take on the world?
Well, I mean, each of those magazines has its own sort of founding ideology. That's one of the differences. But what we hear from readers is that we're much more grounded. We do more news. We're a bit more focused on covering both grassroots events and organizing, like Tracy mentioned, and also kind of the news behind the news, exposing things that may be reported on page 20 of the New York Times or on our front cover. We're a bit more humorous. We've just gone through a redesign in the past year, so I think we can safely say that we're better looking than The Nation, at least. And The Nation tends to be a bit more analytical and theoretical, and a bit more grounded in some of the East Coast debates. One of the reasons the magazine was founded in the Midwest was to isolate itself from those West and East Coast cliques and to be more in touch with the social movements of the time. So.
Well, not far up the road from Chicago is the Progressive Magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, which has traditionally had a close relationship with In These Times. How would you compare In These Times to the Progressive?
The Progressive was rooted in the progressive history of the region and still has ties to that. Progressive's monthly, and for that reason it has a bit more analysis and commentary than we do. We've been a bit more news-focused. And they have certain writers that are attached to the magazine that people sort of identify it with. And I think we're a bit more experimental, open to freelancers, kind of following our name. We're a little, you know, we sort of see who's coming through down the pipeline and try to get them into the pages. So I'd say there's a little bit more, you could call it variety or unevenness, depending on your perspective.
This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guests today on Media Matters are Tracy Van Slyke, the acting publisher. Congratulations, by the way, Tracy.
Thank you.
Of In These Times, and Jessica Clark, the managing editor. We're speaking to them. They're up in Chicago. We're, of course, in the studios here in Urbana. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Tracy or Jessica, the number 333-9455. And our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Anything is fair game. For those of you familiar with In These Times, you know it covers the entire range of political and cultural questions and has deep concern with media in general in its pages, which we'll be talking about on the show today. So I think pretty much as anything is fair game for questioning. Before we go much further, let's talk a little bit more about Jimmy Weinstein, who just died a couple weeks ago after an unfortunate bout with cancer. And how old was Jim at his death?
78.
And Jimmy, now you knew him for how long, Jessica?
I've been with the magazine 3 years, and he was still involved for about a year and a half.
Okay, and how about you, Tracy?
I came after he kind of formally retired, so I heard a lot about him and met him a couple times.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's sort of an unforgettable figure.
Yeah, he kind of stuck with me, though, the kind of times I did meet him.
Yeah, and, you know, for those interested in Jim Weinstein, who was a guest on this show a couple times talking about his final book that he wrote, The Long Detour, If you go to the InTheseTimes.com website now, there is the new issue has a number of articles about Jim, his contribution and memories of him. And I think it's safe to say for those who knew Jim, he was a person who is unforgettable, his impact on them personally and politically and professionally at all levels.
It was amazing, kind of the outpouring after he passed away, kind of all the blogs and the different, even mainstream newspapers like the New York Times, who really did, you know, amazing tributes to him. So the influence he had and the impact he had was really widely seen.
And he was a character. You read those things on our website. There's just some great stories about him.
No, he absolutely was a character, and I think he is he's an unforgettable and irreplaceable person.
Yeah.
You know, Jess, earlier you mentioned how the Progressive has a crew of writers who are associated with the magazine, and In These Times is somewhat more fluid. But, you know, when I think of In These Times, I think of some of the writers who've been working for In These Times for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
Closely identify the publication, and some of our listeners are probably familiar with the writers, don't know how closely attached they've been to In These Times over the years, specifically Salim Muwakkil.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about his work and what he does for the magazine?
Sure. Salim writes, he's now writing a column in every issue. He's been with the magazine, I'd say, about 20 years. I'm not really sure. He came out of this twin legacy of working in traditional journalism and then being radicalized as a black Muslim during the late 60s, I guess. And so he had this sort of, he has an interesting interplay. He's also got an irregular column for the Chicago Tribune. He's a speaker who's on a lot of different programs, and he's also tapped into a lot of different communities, African-American communities, and also media reform. He was a Soros fellow. He writes about prison justice issues. And so he's got a great perspective. He's a great guy, very personable. And a lot of readers really appreciate what he brings to the magazine, which is an African-American perspective that's also informed by all kinds of other movements and by an ability to move in the mainstream world as well. So I think Salim's a great contributor, as well as David Moberg, our labor reporter, who's been with the magazine even longer, is extremely well-versed in all manner of labor issues, deep connections. He can really dig up stories. And he's one of the only dedicated labor reporters in the country.
Yeah.
That's a beat that's really died over the past couple of decades, been replaced by business journalism, which has a much different flavor than David brings to it.
Yeah, that's a very small group of people who do cover the labor beat. I'm afraid you probably get about 25% of the people doing it in the country today.
The total forces,
Yeah, we had a whole labor issue as one of our anniversary issues that really tried to reinforce that, you know, covering and exploring and working with the labor movement is really an important part of building the progressive movement, the progressive media movement. They're kind of joined at the hip while a lot of people kind of push labor to the side as not something that's part of what we should be thinking about. So David Moberg really kind of refocuses people and I think educates a lot of people.
Also, we shouldn't leave Joel behind.
Oh, yeah.
Please, he's your, after all, he is the overall person now.
Joel is working on a book, so he hasn't been in our pages as much.
Now, some people might not know Joel by his first name. We're talking about Joel Bleifuss.
Yeah, Joel Bleifuss. He's been with the magazine about, I think, 18 years. He made his name as an investigative reporter during the Iran-Contra scandal. He also broke stories on the mad cow disease when it first emerged as an issue, various pollution stories, and he writes our editorials quite often when he's not working on his book. And he's also a nice mix. He brings a lot of humor and some mischievousness to the pages, as well as a pretty good, you know, new sense, investigative sense. He's been a real guiding force around here.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guests today, Tracy Van Slyke and Jessica Clark, the acting publisher and managing editor, respectively, of In These Times, the independent magazine based up in Chicago and going strong as it approaches its 30th birthday or 30th anniversary next year. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Tracy or for Jessica, the number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You're both quite young, I think, by the standards of publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Just curious, what's your background, respectively? Let's start with you, Tracy. How did you get, what did you do before you went In These Times? And talk about your rapid career advancement.
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, it is pretty unique. Jessica, I call us the Bert and Ernie of in these times, or it's a dynamic duo because we work very well together and we're both pretty young. And as you said, I started out as a reporter, actually. I worked in Washington, D.C. During the 2000 campaign for Knight Ridder and covered a lot of national political stuff going on there. And then I became the communications director for a grassroots organization called the National Training and Information Center. So I did a lot of communications work with grassroots organizations around the country, teaching them how to work with the media, producing our own publication called Disclosure, and doing all sorts of work. And then I do a lot of consulting on the side with different nonprofits. So then I came to In These Times and really tried to work on building the promotion for the magazine. It's it's recognized across the country. And working with Jessica to do a lot of strategic development. It's been pretty fun.
You know, you're also, to be clear, although you're now the acting publisher and doing a lot of the business side, you also are a journalist. You've written a lot for the magazine.
I have been a journalist for numerous years, and I stick my nose in the editorial side, whether they like it or not.
Well, if you go to the website right now, you've got two stories right up there on the homepage. So it's clearly you're quite active still.
Yeah, I try and be.
And Jessica, what's your background?
I've got a sort of a eclectic background. I worked in nonprofit publishing. I worked at publishers, worked at the Library of Congress, worked at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And then I got into the dot-com boom, did a lot of web publishing. I worked at Britannica.com editing. It was called their society page, but it had nothing to do with white gloves or tea or anything. It was about some social issues. And broke off from that to work on what was then an online magazine called Lip, a bit edgier than In These Times, although we try. It's now in print. And then I wanted to kind of bring some of those skills back into progressive politics. So there's been a bit of a Luddite strain in progressive politics for various reasons, and I thought that there were a lot of tools and skills that I could bring to this sector that would really help it out. So I started as assistant publisher. I moved up to associate publisher, kind of like Tracy, kind of a series of titles rather quickly. And then when our managing editor, Craig Aaron, who was great and wrote a history of the magazine called Appeal to Reason, well, edited it, when he followed his now wife to D.C., I became managing editor. Been managing editor for just over 2 years.
We're talking to Jessica Clark, you just heard, and Tracy Van Slyke today in Media Matters. Again, the phone number, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. They are the managing editor and acting publisher of In These Times, the terrific independent magazine based up in Chicago. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Coles County, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that I had a nice chat with James Weinstein in his office there in Chicago in 1979.
Wow.
I thought I would just mention that.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, just a brief comment, and I'll hang up. For many years, In These Times called itself a socialist publication.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a mistake to change that. I understand, of course, that you feel that's controversial and not too popular a term, socialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that they ought to be, you know, out front in calling themselves a democratic socialist magazine. I think they'd be better off if they did that, if they went back to that tradition. So that's it. I'll just let you comment.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Yeah, when was that decision made to drop the formal title of the socialist magazine or socialist newspaper?
That's a good question. I think it was in the mid-90s.
Yeah, it predates both of your arrival
there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Has there been any discussion about bringing it back?
No, not so much, but although we had a cover story with Bernie Sanders on the cover, and there was some discussion in there about how he feels about calling himself a socialist and how people react to that. We do talk quite a bit about the different terms that are thrown about and what they mean and why we're using them and what they mean to our readers.
Jessica and I are really focusing on revisioning or just really rethinking kind of the mission of the magazine and how we define ourselves and who our audience is. So hearing comments like that is really helpful as we work on continuing to build the magazine with the changing times and so forth. So,
well, do you think in these times, no pun intended, in these changing times, let's say, so I can avoid the pun, that a term like saying your socialist magazine is detrimental to maybe the sort of direction you'd like to see the publication go?
I think it's a question of how people – there have been a lot of language wars over the past couple of decades, mainly driven by the conservatives and their sort of demonization of various terms. And so there's a danger of being a little too reactive. But I think there are also some new configurations that we need to think about that socialism doesn't necessarily cover.
Mm-hmm. Like what sort of stuff?
Well, I mean, like, we've been trying to figure out what the word progressive means.
Yeah.
And I was reading on the Open Democracy website, there's an interesting article by Garo LaMarche, who works at the Soros Foundation, about what an open society needs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are places where, given the sort of the communications era that we live in and the globalized era that we live in, places where you might strike up some strange alliances, let's say with libertarians around free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Socialism doesn't necessarily cover that, but we do in our pages. And so we need terms that reflect some of these emerging realities. And it'd be nice if we, like the French government, had a central agency to like define terms for us and tell us what we could use. But unfortunately, we sort of live in a shifting reality. So right now we're working with progressive. We don't run screaming from socialist. We have plenty of people who write for us who identify themselves as socialist or democratic socialist or have that in their background. But we're just trying to be current.
And accurate.
Right.
Yeah, Tracy, who do you think when you think about In These Times, who do you think the current readers are? I mean, who's reading this magazine in your view?
I think there are a lot of people on the ground, a lot of activists, a lot of organizers, a lot of academics who are kind of immersed in this political and social justice work. I know a lot of politicians read us. It's really interesting because when we're talking about kind of, you know, looking at In These Times in comparison to progressive, I always think of like all these different publications like The Nation, The American Prospect, Progressive, In These Times are all part of a large spectrum that is absolutely necessary. And if one of them dropped off, you'd be missing something very important. So we were at an event last week, actually, with Victor Novasky when he came to Chicago. He's the publisher of The Nation. And someone spoke up and said, you know what, I read in The Nation because that's where I learn about political debate and political theory. I read In These Times to learn about what's going on. And so I think that really defines who our audience is, are people who are very actively involved in their community and kind of on the larger national scene. And that to us is actually very important because when we hear back from our readers, it's not that we're just informing them, we're motivating them as well. So,
what's the current circulation of In These Times?
About 18,000. It's actually not huge, but our website gets over 300,000 unique hits a year.
A month.
I'm sorry, a month.
18,000 actually is a significant increase over what it was just two or three years ago, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's true. Jumped about 50%. It still needs to get bigger. We still need to get our name out there a lot more.
And how does that compare offhand, you know, to the Progressive or The Nation, just to get a sense of where...
I'd
say the Progressive has about three times as many people in their subscription numbers. I mean, circulation numbers are sometimes calculated different ways, so we don't really know. Nation has about 10 times as many readers as In These Times, at least for the print version.
And I know that having had both Matt Rothschild from The Progressive and Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation on the as a guest on the show, that one of the great benefits of the Bush administration has been skyrocketing subscriptions.
Right.
And it sounds like In These Times has been able to capitalize upon that to some extent, too.
Yeah, a bit. We wish we could capitalize more. We wish we were able to send out more direct mails, get more readers. But we've done a lot to really raise our profile online, and that's led to some subscriptions, too, and we're hoping to do more of that.
Yeah.
Now, Jessica, when you sit down with Joel Bleifuss and the other people in the editorial staff to figure out what's going to be on the cover and what stories you're going to put attention to, how do those meetings go? How do those discussions go?
They're very collaborative. Joel's a very collaborative editor. He likes a lot of ideas. He believes in feedback. He believes in that everybody on staff has something to contribute. So we have a monthly all-staff meeting where we sort of brainstorm the issues of the day. Different people have different expertise that they bring to the table. And then, you know, we try to keep a balance of coverage on all – it's a wide variety of issues and politicians and scandals that we cover. So we try to keep a balance between sort of our different approaches. Since the election, we've been following a bit more closely the debates among progressives about how to rally and how to get people to vote for them and how to, you know, get the troops excited. So that's been, I think, a little bit of a, more of a topic that's been in rotation, not just for us, but everybody. So how do the meetings go? We all bring the stories that we've been following. We discuss them. We either assign them, or if we have pitches, we, you know, we run with those. It's kind of flexible.
What are the major stories, Tracy, that in these times is covered in the last couple issues?
There was a big cover story last issue that called "Environmental is Dead, Now What?" And that actually sparked a lot of debate. I think they really kind of, there was a, this whole kind of generational argument within the with the article about, you know, what the new generation can do with the environmental movement versus kind of the old generation. How to, now that environmentalism is dead, how do we rebuild it and birth it again, I guess.
Now, for those who didn't read the article, like me, I confess, what does that mean? The environmental movement's dead? A Sierra Club going out of business or something?
No. Just what they used, Adam Moorbach, who writes for us very frequently, he actually used to be the, was it the president of the Sierra Club, Jessica? He was writing that environmentalism has been very narrowly focused on very small issues that aren't connected to kind of broader progressive issues from criminal justice to you know, politics itself, or Jess, I'm sure you can mention a couple more.
Actually, his argument mirrors a lot of debates that are going on right now in the progressive movement about how single issue focus on various topics has lost momentum, and that people are facing retrenchment, and that what's needed is a larger set of progressive values that can really appeal to people outside of these sort of narrowly defined, professionalized activist classes. And in the case of environmentalism, he's arguing for sort of a re-inscription of environmentalism as more of a holistic concern, about the ways in which the changes in the environment can affect a whole range of social issues, and a new language to describe that, rather than worrying about the spotted owl or whatever people could make fun of and sort of narrowly target, as a bureaucratic interest to sort of reach out and try to get people involved again.
Because what's very interesting about the environmental movement is that there are a lot of people who describe themselves as conservative who also consider themselves environmentalists. And reaching people through those issues and being much more adaptable to multi-issue concerns, that you can really rebuild the environmental movement. What was interesting about that article, actually, is it sparked a lot of debate from a lot of our readers and a lot of environmental activists who say, no, their environmentalism isn't dead, you're wrong. And then actually a lot of African-American environmentalists who work on the environmental justice issue, who said, you know what, we've been talking about this for years. And finally, when a bunch of white guys say it, you know, then it's acknowledged as something big.
Right.
And so, you know, we're interested in having, like, all sides of debate. That's what I think is really interesting about in these times, is we can foster these different debates. And we're working to continue to build on that.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you live July 10th, 2005. My guests today, Tracy Van Slyke, who you just heard, and Jessica Clark, the acting publisher and managing editor, respectively, of In These Times, the independent magazine based up in Chicago. If you'd like to call in, we do have phone lines open, the number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the magazine and what they've been covering. Now, as both of you, I think, as part of your work, read the mainstream press, watch mainstream television to sort of stay on top of the news as it's coming out of conventional commercial journalism. One of the big lines that's often said in this country is that we have a liberal media. In fact, I know there's a group of conservative right-wing radio talk show hosts who are now traveling to Iraq to come back with the good news stories in Iraq, because they think that the conventional the New York Times and the conventional media are presenting such a sort of left-wing, wacky perspective on what's taking place there.
Us wacky liberals.
Yeah. Is that your sense, Tracy and Jessica, that the news media, the mainstream news media, has got a strong liberal bias, and so you guys sort of plug in naturally with those guys?
I guess I have one word response to that. No. absolutely not. Actually, Jessica and I did a joint kind of cover story for a special media issue of In These Times a while back. And one of the things when we were researching kind of the growth of the conservative media was that about 25, 30 years ago, they started a whole campaign to label the mainstream media as liberal. And Jeff can talk more about this because it's more in her area of expertise, but they have really done a great job of not only convincing the general public that the mainstream media is liberal, but convincing the mainstream media itself that they're too liberal. And what they've done is they've forced the mainstream media to check themselves, to never, you know, they start asking certain questions. They stop asking certain questions that could be deemed liberal when they're actually investigative. And they pack their shows with very conservative guests and pundits and so forth. And so I think if you actually, groups like Fairness and Accuracy in the Media, is that what they're
called? Reporting.
Yeah, in reporting. Sorry.
Otherwise, they'd really, be fame.
They've been really tracking the trends of, you know, conservative versus liberal guests in mainstream newspapers and on television, as well as think tanks that are cited. And it's overwhelmingly conservative compared to, quote unquote, liberal.
Yeah, in fact, the article you're referring to that you and Jessica did, Tracy, is in the May 9th, 2005, In These Times. And you've got very beautiful charts in there as well, sort of chronicling both the conservative media machine and the emerging progressive media network, sort of showing them together. And an excellent article. It's gotten a lot of attention on that. And I think that's posted up on the website, too. Is that right?
Yeah.
InTheseTimes.com. Before, Jessica, you talk in more detail about this, I have a question I've sort of wondered. What does the term conservative mean? We talked about progressive and the difficulty in defining that and how you're wrestling with that issue. What does conservative mean?
Well, it's another really fraught term that I think even the conservatives don't know the answer to that. I mean, we have about, if we had a system where we had several parties that we could vote for, then we would have much more precise labels. I mean, I'd like to call them regressive. You know, they're trying to take the country back into an era when women have no rights, when, you know, immigrants are no longer welcome. I mean, but not to be partisan, even though that's
no, but
my job.
Actually, I think there's – I don't know, even a different level than that because, I mean, there's a conservative political philosophy that a lot of Americans, I think, attach themselves to that's not one of just hostility towards women's rights or one of hostility to immigrants.
No, I'm being broad.
No, I know you are. But, I mean, there's a notion of conservatism, I think, that – that it's in favor of small, unintrusive government, not having corrupt governance. And, I mean, that seems to have nothing to do with this conservative media machine or the conservative movement. I mean, that's the point I was trying to get at.
I think there's a couple of different ways that you could describe the people that we're talking about. Corporatist might be one way to describe them. Socially backwards. I'm not really sure what to say, but I agree. I think there's definitely been...
Fundamentalist.
Yeah, fundamentalist. That's a nice one. There's definitely been some debate within the quote-unquote conservative movement, within the right, about some of the moves that George Bush has made, some of the directions that that we see the country going in, and I don't think it's a coalition that can hold together. Well, I hope it's a coalition that can't hold together through the next election, but they have a lot of power and money, so that always helps.
Yeah, there's a definite schism that's emerging. They were very strong where the religious right and kind of the corporatists, as Jessica mentioned, were working well together for a while, or at least under kind of the same values or goals. And right now you can see kind of the promises that were made to each of them, are, you know, either getting dropped or they're not getting the promises they wanted, and you can start seeing the schisms starting to grow more and more.
We're talking to Tracy Van Slyke and Jessica Clark from In These Times, the independent magazine based up in Chicago, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580. The phone number here for folks who'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We've been talking just in the last few minutes about the major article that Tracy and Jessica co-authored, Making Connections, in the May 9th In These Times. Excuse me. Where they chronicle the rise of what they call the conservative media machine and all that's gone into making our media more pro-right-wing politics, and contrast that with what they call the emerging progressive media network. We want to talk some more about that. But first, let's go back to the phone lines and see what our callers want to talk about. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. I was calling to ask the guest to talk a little bit about the difference between liberal and progressive. It may sound like I'm splitting hairs, but occasionally you can see a little bit of liberal opinion on television. I've never seen anything progressive on TV in the past
Very
4 years.
Very good point.
You know, caller, why don't you define it yourself then, since you've got a sense of what you mean, and then we'll let Jessica and
good idea.
And Tracy go after it.
Well, it seems to me that progressives generally want the fairest deal for everyone. They are trying to do the opposite of what the guest just described earlier as the regressives doing. They want to move forward and widen the circle of who's valid, who has a good chance, who's okay in, you know, the United States and the world. It seems to me that liberals are more just about common sense. They have a sense of enlightened self-interest, so really they just want the best deal for themselves and their kids, but they certainly don't vote out of, you know, hostility and judgment, as we see the conservatives doing. So it seems to me that there's a split here. Anyway, that's kind of the way I look at it, and I wondered if the guest could talk about that.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, John Kerry is probably a liberal, but was he a progressive?
No.
So then there's clearly in your minds a difference.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think especially since the Clinton era, liberal has been more associated with a more business-friendly approach, I think, among the progressive community as a more compromising label, maybe a bit more inside the beltway, a bit more concerned about maintaining their own sort of middle class privileges, and less invested in the socialist history that the caller that called in before was talking about, and has been a strong component of American history, one that's not acknowledged frequently enough in our official sources.
Yeah, Tracy?
Yeah, I mean, I think of a couple of things. One is, I think Jessica's right in the sense that liberals are, I think they become a lot more, in the sense, corporate or central and socially central. I also think, when I think of progressive, I think of people who not only are just, you know, thinking politically, but doing things in their own community as well. And they're actively fighting for this stuff. You know, and I also think of things like universal health care, you know, just to list an example. I would even call John Kerry a liberal. I remember seeing him in the debates, and he was asked a question about abortion. And the quivering and the going back and forth, and, you know, this wasn't a man who was standing for an ideal or something that he believed was a basic right. It was something that was much more politicized. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like progressives aren't just about the politics. They're about people's lives. And so for me, that's a real big difference.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Let's see who we've got here. Line four, Farina, you're on the air with Tracy Van Slyke and Jessica Clark of In These Times.
Hi. Thanks for this opportunity. And on the subject of people's lives, I personally feel that people's lives are pretty much being destroyed by this Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And we talked to Howard Zinn about the idea of impeaching him, and he suggested the best way to go, it wouldn't be official, but to start a citizens' tribunal for that purpose, and, you know, like they did in the Vietnam era. And my question is, would you and your publication be willing to actually get behind such a project and help develop it, back it, and help follow through with it for, you know?
Well, you know, actually, we'd be happy to report on it. But we try not to get behind and back anything because we like to present the whole range of options. But I'd like to say there's all kinds of fascinating grassroots activism going on right now, and every person who's willing to do something like what you just talked about, you know, adds a voice to the chorus of voices who are just calling for this president to be held to account. So I'd say, you know, go for it. But as a, we're trying to maintain our line as a journalistic organization. We have our opinions, but we also like to, you know, kind of hold back from the activism when it might compromise reporting on the whole spectrum.
Jessica Tracy, what are the big stories that you see in these times covering that aren't going to get picked up, like the one I think just the caller just said, aren't going to be getting picked up by CNN or Fox News or the local daily newspaper?
There's a lot of different efforts going on right now to continue to elevate the Downing Street memo and its implications.
And a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the Downing Street memo, but like Tracy, give a thumbnail on what that is for those who might not be.
The Downing Street memo, I think it was a year or two, it was before, in the lead up to the Iraqi war, there was a meeting over in Britain with Prime Minister Tony Blair and his top security aides, and there were minutes, the Downing Street memo is minutes taken from that meeting, that document that the Bush administration was trying to fix the numbers, shall we say, or fix the facts about what was happening in Iraq and that there were really no weapons of mass destruction and that Saddam Hussein posed no threat to the American people and so forth. And it really exposed the lies that the Bush administration was claiming in the lead up to the Iraqi war.
And so, yeah. Now, with the bombings in England a few days ago, people argue. I turned on Fox News briefly, and it was almost like the champagne bottles. You hear them going off in the background. The excitement. This sort of vindicated the war in Iraq, because after all, these are barbarians.
Once again, I think that's a very weird connection because it wasn't Iraqi people necessarily that bombed London. I think that the fallacy, once again, that they're connecting Iraq and Saddam Hussein to the bomb to 9/11, and it's a vindication. There, what they're doing is they're slandering a whole group of people. You know, millions and millions of people, basically Arabs and Muslims entirely, which is just completely.
Well,
out of whack.
And which fosters more hostility, which generates more terrorism. It should be just completely obvious to the American public that the way to stop people from getting angry at the United States is not bombing them.
Yeah.
And the lack of common sense that our international policy engages in is just baffling to those of us who have been tracking this more closely.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. We're talking to Tracy Van Slyke and Jessica Clark from In These Times. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm glad to hear this interview.
Okay.
For the two journalists, have you been interviewed by any commercial station on this same subject matter recently?
No.
that's disappointing, but kind of predictable. I'll talk to the Mr. McChesney's guest next week about the Newsday sector.
Oh, you got the Newsday sector on?
Yeah, Danny Schechter will be on next week.
Oh, good.
But I've kind of reached some of the same conclusions that, one, there's the huge lie was that there was an organized East Coast liberal broadcast and print media establishment. And I think it was put in really good perspective by David Brock and the Republican noise machine. And not enough is being said about the wealth, corporate wealth that's flowing in to the machine and its huge institutes. One of them is the American Enterprise Institute, and I forget the other one.
Heritage Foundation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both of those. That's really scary.
Jess, you should probably talk about the map.
So, like I said, I'd like to hear that you were on interviewed by some commercial stations, but I'm starting to ask guests here on WILL's various call-in shows who else is getting the message, and I am, but unless you're you're tuning in, it's not going out over commercial stations.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, caller, for calling in. Jessica, maybe you could now turn briefly to discuss what the caller was alluding to with the rise of the sort of big money that the conservative movement has put into these foundations or from foundations and to groups like the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation.
Sure. Part of what we've been exploring in these maps, and Tracy and I are continuing to do research on this topic, was revealed, as you said, in very great detail in The Republican Noise Machine by David Brock. David Brock also runs an organization called Media Matters, which tracks these issues in real time. If you feel like getting angry, you can go to their website, MediaMatters.org.
I think it's, is it MediaMattersForAmerica.org?
Or no, it's just Media Matters.
Just MediaMatters.org, okay.
Basically, the way that the analysis goes is that conservatives realized during a period when what they saw as their causes and champions were being slammed in the media during the Watergate era, they realized the power of media to affect public opinion, and they decided that the best way to return to power was to invest in media directly. And they did that through establishing a variety of organizations. One of them, as Tracy was talking about, was Accuracy in Media, which charted quote-unquote liberal bias and organized people to protest to various commercial media outlets about that liberal bias to place pressure on the coverage. Some think tanks which already existed and some were founded, whose job was to create both ideology and experts that could go into the media and be interviewed to, quote-unquote, create fair and balanced coverage. And then over the years, a number of other layers have developed to affect political coverage and slant it towards the right. There are some organizations that are known as AstroTurf, which are fake grassroots organizations that counter genuine social issue organizations. Like, for example, there are anti-feminist AstroTurf organizations whose experts will go on to Larry King or whatever against feminist organizations. They also funded a wide range of conservative media and have made some pretty smart choices along the years investing in emerging media. For example, the opportunity on talk radio became clear, and Rush Limbaugh took the stage. Rupert Murdoch saw the opportunity for a 24-hour news station afforded by CNN, and Fox News came into being. And those moves have allowed them to really create kind of a shadow mainstream media.
No, we don't have a whole lot of time left. We've got a caller or two I want to get to before we have to go off the air. But I want to emphasize for listeners that if you go to the May 9th in these times, or if you go to the website in thesetimes.com and look at the article and the charts, you'll also see that much of the discussion is about what progressives are doing sort of strategically to counteract the success the conservatives have had over the past three decades. And maybe Jessica or Tracy, maybe you should chip in here to talk a little bit about what you see going on the other side of the equation.
Yeah, well, if you look at the conservative media, they've really created a very top-down, coordinated, self-sustained system. The progressive side has been much slower in developing. They're very ad hoc, horizontal. And what we really focused on was kind of the infrastructure, the funding, and the impact that each of these kind of two sides have. And what we found was that the progressive media, while it's been growing, it hasn't been as well coordinated. There are a lot of gaps that are in between. One of the biggest gaps have been funding in itself. You have a lot of conservative foundations that will pour money into these think tanks and message makers and into these conservative media, while you've got a lot of so-called liberal foundations and individuals who don't recognize the importance of funding the media or the message makers and think tanks. You've also have a lot of disconnect between the message makers themselves. You've got think tanks in D.C. and New York who are putting out all these different messages and different policies and so forth, while you've got all these grassroots groups on the ground who are actually doing the work, who are actually working with people who are affected by these issues, and they're putting out their own messages.
So there's not a great deal of coordination.
Not a great deal of coordination. Not a great deal of coordination between the progressive media itself, although that has been changing. Jessica and I have been very involved in working with other progressive media outlets and how to strengthen each other as a whole, not just individual outlets.
Well, Tracy, before we go on any further, Tracy and Jessica, let's go back and take our final call and make sure that they get into the deadline.
Yeah.
Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Tracy Van Slyke and Jessica Clark of In These Times.
Yes, I just like their comments on the city of Chicago. Why isn't there a healthy progressive movement in Chicago? Why is Chicago being dominated basically by the Tribune Company and Richard Daley? What makes it so difficult, in your view, as people in Chicago, to have something positive happening in what would seem to be a rather likely place?
Jess, you want to take this or you want me to?
I can talk a bit about some of the efforts that I've been involved in to address this. Most of my efforts are...
Well, first of all, let me ask you, Jess, and Tracy, too. Do you think the caller's assumption is correct or observation is correct?
I wouldn't necessarily say so, actually. I think there is an incredible wealth amount of progressive work that is happening here. I'm sure Jess will mention there are tons of wonderful independent publications and community publications around Chicago, and I've personally seen and been involved in a lot of great political and social justice and progressive work. Richard J. Daley being in charge, there's a machine that's hard to take down. But if you've been following the kind of the stories in Chicago over the last year, he's been exposed to a lot of the scandals he's been involved in or at the helm of. And there has been some rumblings that, you know, in the next election, he might be, there might be a fight about taking him down. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how the Democrats we have and the Democrats we want, and I think people are really starting to push around that. So,
Jess?
One of the things that I've been involved in is the Independent Press Association effort to form an office in Chicago, which really knits together some of the ethnic media and independent media that we've got here. They have a pilot program in New York that's done a great job of bringing ethnic media voices to mainstream and other progressive outlets in the wake of 9/11 around topics related to immigration and other things that really flared up at that point. Let me just reel off a list of some pretty cool publications that we're personally involved with and are members of IPA. Punk Planet does a great job of mixing together culture and politics. Chicago Reader, we wish we had a little better local coverage, but, you know, they're all right. Chicago Reporter does really good social justice investigative work.
Mm-hmm.
Trace, there are a number of little segments. Part of it is...
So it sounds to me like the whole is less than the sum of the parts, though, which might be what the caller was getting at.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the landscape, once again, kind of the maps we did, there's a lot of different individual things happening, but the coordination needs to start happening. I mean, that's what the conservatives did. They knit together all these disparate groups and brought them together. And it has to happen on a local level as well as a national level.
You know, Tracy, we don't have a lot of time left, and it would be remiss of me not to mention that In These Times depends upon people to subscribe to it to survive. I mean, it is so subscriptions are certainly welcome, and people can learn about them at the website. But also a significant percentage of the revenues for In These Times comes from people who, in addition to subscribing, make donations.
Yes.
Above and beyond the call. And what percentage of the revenues for a publication like In These Times is that?
It's over half of our revenue comes from donations.
And I think that's comparable to the Progressive in the Nation. This is pretty much the rule of thumb for all progressive publications that don't get a lot of advertising.
As well as conservative publications.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, we really depend on people to subscribe but also to donate because
people
can put out the kind of journalism we did if we're not supported and we're part of a larger community of people who invest in us so we can give something back to them.
And folks can learn about that at the In These Times website, inthestimes.com. Tracy Van Slyke, Jessica Clark, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio and let Mr. Keeler come in. I want to thank you both very much for being our guests today on Media Matters.
Thank you.
Good luck in these times.
Thank you.
Mighty listeners, recall that 1 week from today, 167 hours, our guest will be Danny Schechter, the news dissector, talking about what's going on in Europe and the Middle East. So thank you all. See you then.
Monday through Friday at 3, join us for Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Tomorrow at 3, from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy to Everybody Loves Raymond, domestic space is now a masculine space. Host Gretchen Helfrich and guests discuss the domestication of the American male on Odyssey, tomorrow afternoon at 3, here on AM 580. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high around 90 degrees and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the mid-60s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high around 90 degrees and east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m., a Prairie Home Companion.